So, it's been unintentional, but you've been getting quite a bit of rugby stuff on these. I know
Yeah,
this.
it's been good. Learning a lot actually. Can hopefully pull it into some of our own rugby soon. Hopefully that's going to kick off again in a couple of weeks if we're lucky. So yeah, here's hoping.
Is Shane still coach there?
Yep. So I think it's his final year this year. And we'll see what happens from there.
Okay. Awesome. Pricey. I messed up yesterday. I thought that question was from you, and I thought 100% it's a loaded question. Like, I just didn't know what you're expecting. And then you send me the private mail saying it's not. Oh, so Simon, I don't, have you met Nikolai Morris? Simon Thomas, I'm talking about, too.
Oh, yes, to me. Sorry, you're talking to me or Pricey.
Do you know Pricey? Do you know who on this call do you know?
Yeah, we've only had a little bit of email contact and people that you know through other people, really. It becomes a pretty small world when everyone's connected. So
Yeah.
it's good to get on board and chat. And you see, you'd say put a face to the name, but most cameras are usually off. So
Yeah.
yeah, it's usually different.
Pricey often graces us with his camera on. There we go. But do you know Nikolai Morris, Simon Thomas?
No, name yes. Name yes, but haven't met that I can remember. Sorry if we have.
It's all right, Simon. I've only just moved to New Zealand, but I'm in the North Island anyway.
Yeah, no, perfect. I was like, I've definitely seen the name, and I've seen it. Were you in? Because we're online. You were online with the chat on Friday last week as well.
Yeah, with the PD meeting. Yep.
Big group that one too, but it's a good group. It's a good initiative from Hirsty and Christos pull that together.
Yeah, definitely.
Well, everyone's making connections here. All right.
I don't think there'll be too many left in the industry that we haven't met on Zoom by the end of the next couple of weeks, to be fair.
Yeah, no, 100%. I got to admit, so this is my fourth call, my fourth thing today on Zoom, official. And when you've got an 8 and 4 year old and you're begging them to be quiet and homework and all that kind of stuff, it's been interesting to say the least. All right, guys, let's kick this off. We've got a few things here we're going to talk about. So as everyone knows, if you can turn your mic onto mute, that would be really appreciated. But we do have the chat option. As always, if you ask a chat or send through a message to everyone, I'll mention your name. And if you send it through privately, if you're a little bit embarrassed or a bit shy, don't worry about it. I'm not going to judge. But I'll ask Simon that question without mentioning your name. Now, when I reached out to Simon and said, "Hey, can we have a chat?" He gave an interesting proposal. He said, "Can I, if it was, Simon, can you just tell me what it was? If this was to earn money or something, how did it go?"
Yeah, I think essentially it's sort of a process I've just come to recently, really, where it's important if there was a so when we're giving information away for free, there's always value in it, and we're sharing information, experience, and it's really important, and somebody always benefits. But the same way, if you were asked to speak at a business lunch that somebody charged, you know, $100, $200 a head, then it would be fair for somebody to, you know, to get a fee within that space, which we often struggle to ask for. And I think when the information's going out through a free and open space, information still has value. So what I've been doing is asking people to, rather than pay for time or information, is to choose a charity that's close to you and just make it a donation that you're comfortable with. It just keeps that idea alive that we're investing in the information. So if you're going to go and catch up with someone for a coffee and pick their brain, usually I'd pay for their coffee. So it's the same. It might only be the $5 cost of a coffee, but it's just encouraging people to invest in sharing information. And then it just widens the impact of, we all get value out of getting online and sharing, but it just makes that impact even wider into other spaces if we can invest into a charity, and then it's done for that purpose as well.
All right, that's awesome. And so what I've done, guys, if you check your chat, I've just posted a link to a foundation that I've been associated with since about 2012, 13, somewhere around there. White Cloud Foundation. It works, helps people with depression. And as someone who lost two friends in about 6 weeks to some bad stuff, yeah, there's a link. And if for the price of a coffee, $5, if you could donate to that in lieu of paying for this information or indeed paying for Simon's knowledge and experience, there's a link there if you don't have your there's a link if you don't have a foundation or charity that you're associated with. Now, Simon, are you on social media, on your Twitter or Facebook or LinkedIn?
A little bit. I'm not highly active. I look and watch and learn and read a lot more than I post. LinkedIn at times I've found really valuable for connections and soaking up information. And sometimes you have to dodge a whole bunch of sort of cold calls of sports equipment being sold from various places around the world that's not in your space. Twitter, I have a Twitter, but I don't post a whole lot. I just use it to keep up with what people are posting and the work that they're doing and soaking up information. So sort of I'm out there, but I don't do a whole lot of posting of information. Always open to sharing info when we get online and have a chat, but I'm not a regular poster of everything.
Yeah. All right. Well, do you have a Twitter handle that you want to just shout out?
Yeah, I think it's STSNC, all just written.
STSNC. All right.
S-N-N-C,
S-N-C, S-T-S and C, the little...
The word and. Yeah.
All right.
So it's all just, it looks like a bunch of scrambled letters.
Gotcha.
Yep.
All right. Cool beans. Well, thank you very much for coming onto this chat. I'm pumped to hear what you have to say and some stuff. Can you just tell us a little bit, were you an athlete at any level?
Not a very good one, like a lot of us in the industry, but always grew up playing across a lot of different sports for enjoyment. So I spent a year immediately after finishing high school on a gap year over in Ireland, and I was involved in sort of a provincial sort of training squad level for rugby there, and that's probably where I got a bit of a snapshot of what some of the industry opportunities might look like, because there was a little bit of resource around it and jobs I never knew existed.
Mm-hmm.
But I think when I first started working full time, I was still playing a little bit of club footy and gradually transitioning out, but wasn't an athlete to a high level. Just played for fun and tried my best and either did well or didn't.
All right. And what led you into coaching? Because if I remember correctly, you started off with a teaching degree, is that right?
No, I looked to the sort of early days in school. That's probably what I connected with most and saw my career path being was teaching in PE. I was sort of passionate about the subject and had some really good teachers that were really inspiring in that space, and that was sort of where I wanted to head. And then by the time I got to the end of school, I was thinking more of wanting to work in sport, and all I really knew of at the time was physio. And then after taking the year in Ireland to think about that and thinking maybe I won't end up in sport, I'll end up rubbing feet in a hospital somewhere, that didn't spin my wheels the same. So it was great to get an insight into some other opportunities within the industry where I knew I could be involved and definitely be on the sport side of things, which is where I really, really wanted to be. So it's sort of how I came towards taking on the study and the work experience that I did.
Okay, because you also had a bit of experience there with personal training in the early days.
Yeah, little bits. While I was studying, just to make sure you actually got some practice in, really. So it wasn't all just theory and books and learning. And I was fortunate that the course that I studied on had quite a few practical elements to it as well. But on one hand, you had to put those things into practice, and on the other hand, you had bills to pay. But I couldn't quite get enough hours to pay all the bills while I was studying by doing that. So the gym that I was working in, I had to leave and take a job at a sawmill that gave me more hours but paid the bills. And I did that for a year and a half while I waited for our little certificate to grow into a degree that I could follow through with. So. So I'd say there was a little bit of sort of part-time work in and around the gym sort of while studying. but it was always sort of trying to make my way across into the sporting space. That's just where we're really, really passionate. There's a bigger industry out there in the private space. And there's, I think everybody's, or a lot of people set their sights on sport, but it's pretty narrow in terms of its opportunities and its scope. But it's the bit that I really enjoy. So it was what I was really driven to try and get into.
Okay. So, and how did you get into it?
Again, through the course that I did, I was based up in Nelson, which is just a little bit north of Christchurch where I grew up. I ended up there after the year over in Ireland. I was registered to come back and move down to Dunedin down south and study physio. And there were sort of two things. I'd changed my mind from physio to something in an S&C space or a sports performance space. And also I'd lived in Ireland and it was dark and cold and rainy, so Dunedin wasn't that appealing anymore. So, and Nelson with the highest sunshine hours in New Zealand, even though I had a friend who was just going to do a 1-year certificate, Polytech sort of a sport and recreation certificate. I managed to negotiate sort of a last minute entry onto that course to at least study that and get a feel for it and see if it was definitely what I wanted to do. And that had a number of different observational and sort of practical hours involved in that first year that helped me really find out and sort of reaffirm that was what I wanted to be doing. And I got to direct my energies a bit more. So that opened up the opportunities to different sports at different levels to figure out really where I wanted to try and head to.
And when we've caught up before, you mentioned the word linear with regard to your career. It really has been, hasn't it?
Yeah, unusually linear, as I often put it. It's not very often. So my journey's been, if you looked at the Crusaders who I work for at the moment, sort of the main franchise or the region, and then there's different teams and academies kind of within that region as a pathway that a player would go through. And I've sort of essentially gone through the coaching side of that pathway, working with every different school group and academy group and feeder team on the way to the role that I'm in now. So it's not very often that throughout that sort of 10 to 12 years that you wouldn't have to move sideways to another area to take a job opportunity so it's been interesting. It's been really valuable to be able to work through that process and sit in all those different seats on the way, but I've also had to be aware that my learning and my vision and focus isn't too narrow and it's only about that one single way. So I've been pretty diligent making sure that I can learn from different areas and different spaces along the way so that my knowledge and experience is a little bit wider than just that narrow trajectory, really.
I want to come back to that, but do you find now pretty much sitting at the top of the tree that having those experiences of academy, school, Tasman, one of your, what do you call it, feeder clubs, regions, do you find now you've got a better appreciation and actually helps you with where you are now?
Yeah, I find it really useful. I definitely found it, felt it's a strength, just having seen what I needed in all those different chairs from where I'm sitting now. That's sort of funny. I guess it, in a way, it's the top of the tree, but we're all sitting in the same garden. Mm-hmm. So it's really reaffirmed for me that if I'm only watering the leaves around me, the tree's not going to be any good. But so I've got to keep watering the roots, because all our players and all our coaches and all our support staff are all coming up. That's where everybody's coming from. So to be able to stay really connected to that, and on one hand, thinking, when I was in those seats, what did I think I needed from further up the chain? What did I feel like we weren't getting that we needed? But also knowing now that there's different people in those seats and they've got different challenges, so they might need different things. So not assuming that they'll want what I wanted, but remembering to ask and provide if I can. So definitely been useful.
So, and in your role, I mean, is your position, let's win with the Crusaders, or is it let's look after the roots and our foundations?
It's both. Both go together, really. Like if you look after the roots and the foundations, there's a higher chance of the Crusaders winning and winning more than once, not just winning once and then having a 5-year gap where you've invested in just the group and the competition that's right in front of you. So It's a big emphasis within our organisation. Like we're a, it is a performance organisation, and you know your fans and your sponsors and your business need you to win trophies. But we're a development organisation, and we grow people. And then the sort of shiny piece of metal is sort of a byproduct of that if things go your way.
And just on that, what are some of the things that you think you, that you're doing well, not at the top end, but for those roots?
I think a big emphasis for me and sort of a, over the last 4 years has been making sure that we resource down. So as an example, if we need, we're only as good as the players that come to us out of our academy or other elements and the coaches that come out of those spaces anyway. So we need to know that our players understand what's required of them and have like the education that's needed for them to be self-reliant, self-aware, and we can just focus on performance when they're at that team side of things. So if we're, for example, if we're negotiating a contract to put GPS in place for the Crusaders, it's important to factor in which different teams are going to need that kind of tech so that when players get to us, they know what we're using it for, how we're trying to use it. They have that understanding. And you try to make as few things as possible new when somebody gets to the Super Rugby environment so they can just train and play. I mean, our academy do a great job of how they recruit recruit from around the country and recruiting on they'll identify on talent and then recruit on character and retain on commitment. And so...
Wait, just say that again. So identify on talent...
Yeah, they'll identify on talent. If you're good enough, you'll sort of be on the radar. And late developers do sort of slip through the cracks. But generally, you've got to be at a certain level to be seen as an opportunity to bring into that process. Mm-hmm. And then you'll recruit from that talent list based on character, which is it's a matter of getting to know the coming out of school, so they're 18, 19 years old. Sitting down with, getting to know them, get to know their parents, talk to their school coaches, teachers, family, friends, and really get to know the person. And it's not about whether they're a good or a bad person. It's whether they're going to fit within the environment and make the most of it. And whether it's sometimes it's whether it's the right time for them. And then you'll retain on commitment, whereas some fail to commit to what's needed. And others, it's not necessarily a failure. It's just they're juggling too many things and they can't balance the requirements of the academy and wanting to be a pro rugby player in the university and part-time work and it's just a bit too difficult, and you do them justice by allowing them to move aside from that process, and they might re-enter at another date or at another team and still get a great career. So
that's awesome. I like that little model there. Now coming back to what you were saying, being in the one system where when you're, let's say, at the roots and there was someone else at the top and they've guided you and shaped your thoughts, what strategies have you put in place to make sure that you don't only see things one way, that you're not just a clone that reproduces and maybe even does things that have always been, you know, what's the saying? We do it because that's the way it's always been done. How have you kept fresh with that, with regard to that?
Yeah, I think it was definitely a strength for me. I got to sort of in the early days. I was very much like yourself. Sent Ash Jones an email and asked if I could come and watch. And as open as he is, he said, "Yep, just give me a ring and let me know." So I've still got that old email. I think it's in July 2004 that I first asked him if I could come and watch, and he invited me in. And then ever since then, there were different. I got different little snapshots of living in Nelson and then helping out through a pre-season and having a look and having a watch and seeing how things unfolded and how things ran and how he coached and how the program ran. And then gradually got my hands on some more work in that space up in Nelson around the Tasman Rugby Union. And that grew through, you know, the school level, the academy level, taking over the Mitre 10 Cup, ITM Cup side. So I got to put things into place, get in, have a look at a snapshot, but also kind of grow in a different environment. And one of the best things was learning in Tasman, because you were a one-man band and you had no resource and no money and limited staff and not many Super Rugby players. And so you had to you had to become a bit of a generalist in a way, but be really smart around how you went about things and what you prioritised and focused on. So I could see what was happening at Crusaders and what would work, but I could also see what I couldn't do. And then as I got more involved within the Crusaders over the years, you can see, like, I managed to see how Ash was operating the program, how Carl Jennings operated the program for a year, and then Mark Drury, who was there before me that I was assisting, and how he ran the program. So managed to get a feel for the things that I felt were working, but also had ideas of what I would maybe do differently.
Mm-hmm.
And not because things were being done wrong, but just because I've got a slightly different approach and the needs change each year based on what you need. So, and fortunately, when I was at Tasman, people were really open. I went and spent time with Ash. I went and spent time with Andrew Beardmore down at the Highlanders. I went and saw Damien Marsh over at the Reds. My mum worked for Air New Zealand at the time, so I could get staff travel. So I flew to London and across to Dublin and crashed on people's couches and visited Leinster and Wasps and sort of just tried to pick up on different things and different environments and learn from different people. So I could sort of, it's probably quite a shotgun. I cast a pretty wide net, to be fair, with a shotgun approach of going around and seeing as much as I possibly could. And I probably approach that a little bit differently now. But it was really valuable.
In what way would you approach it differently?
I think now if I was looking to grow in terms of my own personal development or to grow the program that we're delivering with our group or for our coaches, rather than looking out and seeing what's good and trying to make that fit, I'll just look within and say, what do we need to do better based on review and reflection, based on the players that we're going to have, the coaches we're going to have. And then it might be, okay, now who does that really well? I'll go and see what they're doing and narrow that focus and see what I can bring back. Rather than going out searching for ideas, actually kind of narrowing what I want to improve or achieve and then going about a plan for how to do that.
Mm-hmm. But to be fair, you probably need some experience to do that shotgun thing, to just be aware. If you know, in the beginning, you don't really know what you don't know, so it's hard to reflect. So I think you're being a bit harsh on yourself if you think you did anything. If you did anything wrong, like that would be a very natural progression.
Yeah, and it was definitely right at the time. I think I do it differently now. If I'm trying to specifically improve the Crusaders from one year to the next, it's mm-hmm. about what that team's going to need based on how the dynamics will change within that group. The personal development side's a little bit wider, but they'll still narrow it down to, do I need to work more on the mechanics or dynamics, like the nuts and bolts or the leadership side of things or the people management side of things? So, absolutely. I think I built a nice wide base, I feel, like sort of the inverted pyramid, or a proper pyramid, really, a wide base of knowledge, and then slowly narrowed it down as the years gone on, but without kind of trying to ignore other things.
Yeah. Well, I've got... just remember, guys, if you want to ask a question, feel free to send through a chat. And Simon, we've got a few private messages coming through of people donated, so that's pretty cool. And again, if you're new to this call, Simon's asked you can make a small donation to a charity of your choice. And I've been using White Cloud Foundation, so feel free to jump on that if you want to. So thanks very much for that.
Thank you. Simon, I won't be chicken.
Yeah, you don't have to send a receipt.
It's completely up to you. Isn't that awesome? Yeah, awesome. Thank you.
Now, Simon, I'm interested because so far we've been talking, and I'm just using this analogy, top of the tree and the roots, but you actually, there's still the All Blacks ahead of you. Do they do similar sort of things? Is your relationship from Crusaders to Tasman similar as All Blacks to Crusaders? Is there something similar like that?
It's something that's definitely pulling back together again a lot closer now with the sort of the situation we're currently in, where we're I think I read it quite well the other day. We're not all in the same boat. We're in different boats, but we're in the same storm. And everybody's losing different elements of resource, and we're all going to have to help each other. And it's definitely been a focus of and a strength for the Crusaders, I feel, as an organisation. And how we've done that, and the All Blacks understand the same, that every All Blacks come up through that pathway as well. Every All Black coach and S&C coach and support staff come up through that same sort of pathway. So the investing down is important, but it's Yeah, it's been an interesting balance because there's Nick Gill as All Blacks S&C coach has got, he's got a big role just being the All Black S&C coach and making sure that All Black players and All Black coaches get what they need. So it's an interesting balance of trying to invest down for him and to strengthen New Zealand rugby as a whole, because what he gets will be stronger without taking him too far away from what his core role is and what his contract is. So it's definitely something we're pulling together a lot closer now. Like the academy system used to be really aligned and structured from an NZR perspective, and then I think the unions sort of pushed back a little bit at one point and said, we want to do it a little bit our own way, so just give us the money and we'll figure it out rather than following your syllabus. So NZR sort of gave that freedom, and now it sort of comes around full circle and the unions are starting to say, you know, can you give us more leadership? Can you give us more resource? Can you invest here? Can you tell us what you want from us? So it's always that you're always moving along that spectrum. So I think we're in a really good space at the moment. Super S&Cs and All Black staff, we're on a Zoom once a week at the moment, and then we're doing calls where it'll have All Black staff, Super Rugby staff, and the Mitre 10, the provincial academy, and Mitre 10 Cup staff on the same call just to talk about alignment within that group. Because they said that the players pass between all those programs at various times of the year. It's good. I think the thing that's really helped it in recent history is shifting towards a focus on what's best for the player. So you don't end up with competing demands of the All Blacks want someone at this and Super wants them at this, but Mitre 10 Cup wants them over here. If it's a holistic picture of what's best for the player, and then we all figure out how we support that picture, the player only gets one message. And the reality is they're gonna want to do what's going to make them an All Black. And that's what we're here for, is to help players become All Blacks because they've grown up with that dream.
Well, to me, it's almost wider than that, because when I was there, again, this is going back a number of years, 2006, I remember the comment, I can't remember who the CEO was, but we were chatting and there was basically this admission that the Crusaders knew, I won't say underpaying, that's the wrong word, because that gives a negative, but they knew that the coaches and players could get more if they went onto the open market, but they chose not to because they wanted to be in the Crusaders system. Have you experienced that?
Yeah, there's definitely been cases of that. I think from a player perspective, like Dan Carter was pretty open about that when he was based living in Auckland. The family was in Auckland, but he was at one point he was commuting to Christchurch to play, where he could have got more money to play for the Blues, but you know, but the Crusaders was home and he'd grown up there, and so he had that real connection to the place. But for others, in terms of a recruitment perspective, like I said, there is a draw card there. Our we've got a history of creating All Blacks through our academy process, through Canterbury and now through Tasman and through the Crusaders. That it is it's been a vehicle for players and coaches and staff towards the All Blacks, if that's a goal. And there've been individuals and staff who have gone up to that All Black level and not enjoyed it. Ash had some challenges where he didn't really get to do what he loved doing, which was the long campaign journey and the periodization of a long season. And you see players go from, I get to work with players now that I've worked with since they were 13 years old and they're becoming All Blacks. So that's really is really enjoyable. I've sort of probably found that's, I connect with that, and that's what gets me out of bed to go and do what I do every day. And so working with national teams like Māori All Blacks is just so different. They arrive and you've got a week's notice and you're pulling programs together and you've got three games that you have to win otherwise, because you're under pressure to win because you're playing in black, and then you hand them back to someone else and away they go. So it's very different. It's a very different picture. So it's probably something I've learned a bit in the last couple of years around, you know, you start out writing your progression. I want to be working at Mitre 10 Cup by this time, and I want to be leading Super by here, and then the end goal is to work with the All Blacks. Whereas it's interesting for some people that actually takes them away from the things they're most passionate about if you just try to climb the next rung on the ladder.
Yep. Oh, I get that. Now, as someone who's been involved with this organisation, I mean, just New Zealand rugby, you know, the term, the the most successful team of all time, you guys do really well in Super Rugby. What you know, and as someone who's been to these other organisations around Australia and the UK and so forth, what do you think the Crusaders as an organisation does well that maybe other teams or other organisations aren't doing as well?
Yeah, it's a good question. It's always a tough question, but it's a question that's always asked. And I've been listening to a couple of podcasts of our some of our player, current and former players recently, and they get asked the same question. So it's really interesting listening to their answers and coaches the same. And it's no sort of disrespect to any other environment, but we had a session with NZR. It was late last year where it was a leadership and a culture building session. They talked about, you know, all teams have the same things written on the wall, but some teams live them and some teams don't. And that's culture is just a daily interaction of relationships and what those look like. It's the way that things happen around a place. And for the Crusaders, the continuity has definitely been a strength. And it's a history of success is a strength because you've got people there who know what it takes to get success. But it can be a curse because if you just try to carry something on and success glosses over cracks, then people overtake you pretty quickly. So I think one thing we've gone back to as Crusaders in the last 4 years, sort of with the current coaching group and even the last year of the previous coaching group, was not trying to continue something, because at that point in 2016, for example, you could say the Crusaders had still won the most titles out of anybody in Super Rugby, but the other hand, we hadn't won it for 7 or 8 years, so we weren't that successful. Like, I mean, we were, because they'd got to 2 finals, and give or take a penalty or a whole lot of travel, were beaten on the day. But I think we got back to building, which is you look at what the Hurricanes did to win their title, what the Highlanders did to win their title, what the Lions were doing in South Africa they didn't quite get the trophy, but they did some incredible things and achievements by how they built a group and a culture over time. The Chiefs built a culture. It's funny when you look back at it across different teams and different environments around the world. It seems like wherever Wayne Smith goes, that stuff follows. And that's fascinating to see, whether it's the All Blacks, the Crusaders, the Chiefs, Kobe at the moment over in Japan. He's unbelievable and on field and off field stuff. So, but continuity is key. I think we've got the lowest staff turnover and the lowest player turnover, the highest number of centurions. You create a place that's home, and people, A, they want to come to, but B, they never want to leave, and they really enjoy it, and it feels like family, and it is family. So there's a real, you get a lot of sense of that when you hear the players talking, and every player's got the same story, but it has different names. So one of our rookies now will walk in and talk about the first time they sat in the shed, and a Richie Mwanga and a Joe Moody and a Kieran Reid are walking around and making them feel really welcome and part of the group. And Andy Ellis will talk about a Reuben Thorne and a Justin Marshall, and an Andrew Merton's doing the same thing. And so it's you get that real continuity over time, that they pass on that experience that they had. Mm-hmm. And the only thing you ask in this environment is if you're going to come into it, then you're going to contribute and grow it and leave it better than when you came in. So, and how you go about that, you can do in your own way. And that individuality becomes a real strength, because if you're all trying to do it the same way, it gets very stale. Whereas if you've got engagement within the diversity of your group, you get some real strength from that and you grow from it.
Yeah. When I was talking to Ash on one of these calls, you know, I had a lot of time to reflect coming into it, and the humility of the Crusaders players and the All Blacks. This is in the lead up to the 2007 World Cup, and the guys, they would come to me and shake my hand, and I was just kind of this, you know, I would have been similar to you in 2004. You're kind of there wide-eyed, and they coming up and asking you questions and stuff. And you're just like,
yeah,
you're an All Black.
Yeah. Yeah. But the first person that came and said hi to me and asked me about myself was Dan Carter. And I was like, hi, I'm Daniel. Yeah, I know. So it was fascinating. And then just some of the personalities, like there's just really warm, good people that you get. I know someone like a Casey LaLala who he lived with Ash for a period of time there too, mm-hmm. but every time you saw him, it wasn't just a quick hi and bye, like they generally stop and engage and get to know you. And Ash sort of did the same. He pops in from time to time. He's got a permanent space in our office that he's always welcome just to drop in and chat shop, mm-hmm. or just chat life. And the other staff that we've got there just draw so much out of him, and so do I. So and he said, gee, that Richard Wong is a class act. He just came straight up to me and introduced himself, and he said, look, you don't know me, but I know who you are, and you know, thanks for everything that you've done for this place. Because awesome. Things like that are genuine. So mm-hmm. Things like that can be a little bit forced. So there's some of that really, really simple human stuff. Not to say that it doesn't happen in other environments, but it's definitely something that's been a staple at Crusaders.
Yeah, that's awesome. Now, I want to just chat a little bit about S&C stuff. In your transition from Tasman, which is ITM, are the players fully professional there, or are you training before and after work?
Some of them are. In season, during the season, they're fully professional. And then outside the actual season, they're either involved in Super Rugby or they're either studying or working and training mornings and evenings. So it's sort of... when I was at Tasman, the bulk of our squad were in that semi-professional sort of group, and we had a sprinkling of Super Rugby players. And the strength of that organisation now, they've got mostly all Super Rugby players or All Blacks and a sprinkling of club players taking an opportunity. So, but it was very much semi-professional for most of the year, and then 12 to 14 weeks of sort of full-time in-season while you sort of continue doing the academy.
Okay. Now, from a coaching point of view in general, but specifically looking at the US&C, how did some of your paradigms change moving from ITM Cup to Super Rugby?
One of the things that's really interesting is your Mitre 10 Cup, or the ITM Cup, was really challenging because of certain things like the turnarounds of games. You might play on a Thursday, Friday, Saturday, or a Sunday, or you might have a midweek Wednesday. So it's a really different competition dynamic to a Super Rugby, which is generally Friday or Saturday on a weekly basis, and it's a whole lot longer. So the Mitre 10 Cup's a lot more of a sprint to Super Rugby, but you don't get a pre-season at all, really. I mean, you get the extended period of time with your non-professional players, and the other players will come out of Super Rugby, but basically you assemble your actual contracted squad about a week or two before your first game, because that's when you can afford to, and that's when everyone's available, and you go from there. Whereas Super Rugby, you can generally plan a pre-season. There's a short pre-Christmas period and a January period before you start playing. So I think some of the pieces of Mitre 10 Cup were really useful for when I worked with New Zealand 20, for example, on short turnarounds. That was really valuable. Whereas drawing on going into Super Rugby, I probably drew more on the experience that I'd had of preparing that sort of wider training group as a pre-season to in-season type process, which was good. And also, when you're working with hardly any resource or people, you learn to streamline things and prioritise things as well. So that was really valuable to carry over into... I know when I moved from Tasman to Canterbury, just the change, like having a gear man who looks after the equipment rather than the S&C coach having to do it all. So that, which took a while to get my head around because you're used to doing all of it. So it's knowing what you can apply and what's different, and if you get a little bit more time or energy from not having to spread yourself so thin, how you direct that into the right spaces. But it's definitely, it's a longer challenge. It's a different challenge. The level of experience of player is different. The level of pressure is higher, but generally you've got more experienced players. So in a way, it's sort of, I'd say, easier. Maybe not easier is not the right word, but it's, you know, you do more coaching with an academy group or a Mitre 10 Cup group, and more managing with an experienced Super Rugby team. And you still got to coach them, because for the best player in the world to get better, they still want to be coached. That's, you respect them by coaching them, not by assuming that they don't want to get any better. But they definitely know the processes. You've got players who have played, I've been fortunate, I've had players who have played 100 tests and 200 Super games. So they know the ins and outs of things pretty well. So you can focus your time into some of the younger players or some of the newer players, but even the senior players take a leadership role in that. So yeah, the Mitre 10 Cup usually it's a lot more educational, and you'll do a lot more coaching, and you've just got less resource and less time.
Mm-hmm. Which is actually quite good for your development if you've got less resources, so you can learn your speed and your power and your strength and nutrition or whatever.
I'm so happy that I learnt in that environment, where I think when I first got the role for going from Academy Tasman to the leading the Mitre 10 Cup role, that arose basically, NZR sort of removed both Tasman and Northland from the competition for financial reasons, and Tasman had run themselves into the ground, and managed to, by public support, by public donation, by loans from Canterbury and NZR and Crusaders, and incredibly tight budgeting, managed to get the team back into the competition. But it meant that the jobs available were very wide and shared, but they didn't pay much. But I was straight off the back of study. so you do it for free, to be fair, for the opportunity. So it really didn't matter, because you just got to lead something. And I think that's a strength of the New Zealand system. And we did a professional development call, and I chatted to Charlie Higgins recently as well. Yep. Who's at Leinster now. I should have mentioned before, I went to visit Charlie at the Force as well. Even when I was assisting at Crusaders, he's like, yeah, mate, come on in. So
great guy.
Awesome. Himself and Ash were great around openness of information and sharing. And, you know, you don't get stronger by hoarding information or locking people out. Mm-hmm. And so he's at Leinster now, and we've sort of been trying for a while to get our two performance teams online and just share information. And he does a great job of that with his group. And so he brought us online with it. And that was a really good process for us, just to share that info and keep that going. But one thing that I've had a chat since with sort of an S&C coach within his team environment is, because if you're there, and it's similar to an SA sort of model perhaps, or maybe in an Australian model, in some cases, is that you just stay at the one team. So at Leinster, no matter which competition they're playing in between European and Pro 14, it's Leinster, and it's the same players and the same coaches and the same staff structure. Whereas Gareth, who works alongside me with Crusaders, then gets to lead the Canterbury program in the Mitre 10 Cup. And I got to do that when I was assisting Mark with Crusaders. So you actually, it's such a great opportunity. You can come up with all these ideas during Super that might not work, and then try them in Mitre 10 Cup. And make sure that they fit. So you actually get to lead something, which is, it's awesome. Well, I really hope that they maintain that structure and the ability for us to keep doing that.
It's been a massive theme talking with some of the high performance managers and head coaches in these Zoom calls, because how ill-prepared you can be in many of these systems from going from assistant to head coach. And it's just making all the decisions and putting all the pieces together, which is a skill that you only get through practice. You can read all the textbooks, you can watch all the videos, you can go to the webinars, you can actually watch your mentor do it all. And so I think any system where you get an opportunity to follow and an opportunity to lead is one of the best developments for higher levels.
Yeah, absolutely. It's the same in any form of coaching, really. Like, if you want to be in a sports context, if you want to be a head coach, then you need to develop being a head coach. If that's where you want to go to, and you just have to ignore the level and not worry about the logos or what the structures may be, rather than being the best supporting actor for for a whole lot of different Oscars, or being the best assistant coach. And some people just like to be in that space. They don't want all the extra clutter that comes with the managerial side of the other roles. And as I said before, people have kind of gone up that ladder and gone, oh, I don't want to talk to marketing about promos, and coaches about contracts, and manager about the schedule, and all these other different moving parts. I just want to write programs and coach. So you decide to shift back down the back down that stream, and you find where you're actually most passionate about. But yeah, it's definitely become a big part of my role. But I enjoy it because I like to connect all the pieces and work with people in the dynamics. And I've got outstanding people who are great with the mechanics that I can lead and support in doing that. But having said that, I'm not ready to just sit in an office just yet. I still like to program and coach and get my hands on and be in a team environment because I love that. But sometimes I've got to get out of other people's way. And if I've asked them to do a job, don't do it myself, let them do it.
Yeah, 100%. Now, I want to talk about this, your progression from, traveling domestically to traveling internationally with Super Rugby. But before we do that, you just touched on your team. Simon, can you tell us how you are operating in terms of what does the athletic preparation department look like at the Crusaders?
Very different now to what it was a month ago.
Let's go back 6 weeks.
Yeah, which to be fair is that's been, our players are awesome at the moment. It's nice being at home and getting out with the dogs, but the personnel side of the organisation has been the biggest challenge. That's been it's pretty tough to be fair. So, but if you go back to during Super Rugby early this year, so there's myself. Name of the role is head of physical performance. Gareth Duda is strength and conditioning coach, lead strength and conditioning coach. And
so, how do those two roles differ? I mean, obviously, you've got more responsibility, but it's one in the gym, one on the field, or
it is a little bit in a way, just by skill set and passion. Really, we both cross over. Both you just know actually who's leading and who's assisting in which space. So when it comes to the S&C side of things, we don't have a head and assistant. We've just got ourselves as two strength and conditioning coaches, and some areas we lead and some areas we assist the other. And Gareth's outstanding, and his sort of passion in the areas that he really wanted to lead is in that strength and power and speed space. And I said he gets to do the leadership skill set within the Canterbury program as well. So we try to give him enough opportunity within Super Rugby to build those so that he's ready to lead a Super Rugby program, whenever he takes one on. But you say the roles differ a little bit. He can be on the gym, which releases me sometimes to go down to the coach's office and talk about the week structure, player management, training detail on the field, and bridge the gap. Our sports scientist that we've had online for the last 4 or 5 years is Sean Owen, who's South African. Has been with us sort of through that period, both across Canterbury and Crusaders, and his role's essentially turning numbers and data into pictures that I can actually understand and present and make decisions from. So he's a translator for me, to be fair. He'll translate research papers into infographics for me. Okay. He'll translate numbers and data into a graphic that I can use to make a decision and influence training, and he's a filter. You get all sorts of offers and advances from different technology, and there's so many different methods and ways that we can be trying to improve that we can use him to basically filter and write this method, do the research, look into it, present back to us, and let us know whether you think it fits for here. And he can also look from that side of things and say, this is where we need to improve. The medical team will use them. The coaches will use them for special projects between him and our analyst, just to make sure that...
So what's the difference between an analyst and a sports scientist? Where do they...
Our analysts are more in the rugby space. So they'll look at game and training and skill set and tactics and technical and that side of things with the coaches. Whereas our sports science will look at the physical physical side of things and the stress and recovery side of things for us. So the areas that Sean would lead for us is anything data collection and presentation, anything around recovery, anything around our player monitoring and how we use that to make decisions and streamlining it. And then I brought in this year Stefan van Gruting, who's our Academy SNC coach.
Sounds like another South African.
Yes. Yep. Another South African born. He's full time with our academy, but the one thing that he sort of, because he's full time with the academy, he does our under 19s, but he doesn't get to lead the Mitre 10 Cup or Super Rugby, so he can kind of get boxed in with only the academy, and he'd like to work with teams. So on one hand, it's great because it gives him access to team environment, and for us, this year was really important. We got a lot of new players in our squad that came from the academy, and he's worked with them for 3 years. So he comes with all of the knowledge of how those players operate and what they respond to and how we can actually get the best out of them rather than see the best out of them in 2 or 3 years. Mm-hmm. If they get picked round one, how do they perform? So that's been really useful. That's sort of a little part-time, very part-time addition to his role. And then Conrad Goodhue's our dietitian, who we had online for 3 days a week. He works across, again, he's a resource that goes across Crusaders, Academy, Canterbury, Tasman, so that everything's aligned. Mm-hmm. And John Quinn, in terms of the mental skills space, is a performance mental skills for which is a blend of one-on-ones with players, supporting coaches and
Wait,
staff.
John Quinn from Essendon and GWS or another John Quinn?
No, it'll be a different John Quinn. Yeah, Quinn, he works within high performance sport with a couple of different sports and athletes and out of one of the schools here as well. So he'll support us in that space. But I say the current environment has reduced our staff down to myself and Gareth. So which is bloody tough for those individuals.
Yeah, sure.
People first and foremost, but then for us, we've got to figure out now, right, what can we keep doing, what can't we keep doing, how do we operate without spreading ourselves too thin and trying to do everyone's work. Mm-hmm. So the learnings from Tasman are going to be very applicable in the near future with Crusaders. So it's an outstanding team. I've been so fortunate to have that group around me and the way that they've kind of grown, and I've been able to give them leadership of areas rather than telling them what I want from them. They can lead a bit more of a compass, to be fair. Like, I've got to give our direction. That's my role in leading that group. But it's like Google Maps. There's a number of different ways to get there, and they'll figure out the best way and then tell me what they need in terms of support so we can follow that path or adapt. So and then there's a UC University of Canterbury Masters program that we have student placement for that need to complete projects and hours within our group. So a couple of years ago, I split that from asking one person to volunteer full time across everything to having somebody in the sports science space, somebody in the S&C space, and someone in that nutrition space.
Yep.
Ask for less time, but they can direct themselves to what they're most passionate about.
All right. Good. I've always had the impression that the New Zealand sports teams were a lot leaner than many of the Australian sports teams in terms of, so often you'll have in Oz, you'll have a speed coach and a strength coach. And have you found that in your travels?
Yeah, I have. You definitely visit other programs around the world where there's a lot more moving parts. Some of the rugby teams in the UK might have 6 or 7 S&C coaches, so they can just have a session at a 1-3 sort of ratio. But there's definitely a lot less. There's less money in Super Rugby than there is in the AFL or the NRL. There's no money in any of it at the moment, of course, but there's the budget side of things and the structure side of things are different. And rugby, especially in New Zealand, it's definitely spread across, you spread across multiple levels, whereas in AFL, you know, you've got that season with that club and you've got an in-season and off-season. You're not competing to the same level with an international game and those sorts of things as well. So You just look around Auckland, for example, and you've got two Mitre 10 Cup teams, a basketball team, a Super Rugby team. They're all competing for the same sponsorship dollar and the same bums on seats through the gates. And so, yeah, there's...
I see it as a strength, though. I find New Zealand's,
absolutely.
Yeah, like sometimes I think because we've got these bigger budgets, we use them. I'm not always... It was very interesting. And again, I'm going back 14 years, but much like you, I'd traveled around and spent time with, you know, different AFL, NRL, Super Rugby clubs and stuff. But when I went to, it was basically just Ash. It was Ash there at Crusaders. The gym was, you could see each era of budget that the equipment had been bought, like the different plates and stuff. And the platforms weren't even platforms. It was just like rubberized mats on the side to protect the carpet. But this was one of the most successful teams of all time. And they've got one person pretty much across everything. And then you go to these other clubs whose facilities and structures outwardly looked way better, but they didn't have the results.
Yeah, and you can spread too thin. You could have 10 amazing people, but if 10 amazing people are trying to do 3 amazing things each, that's 30 things that you're trying to achieve. Whereas one person doing 5 things really well can be more effective at times. So. Yeah, I think the challenge, Super Rugby has definitely grown in terms of its length of season and its the squad size and things like that. So some of the resourcing's changed to suit that, but you always got to be very, very wary that you're not just creating a role and just trying to justify that role by finding things for it to be doing and that sort of thing. So you can very easily overcomplicate things or over-resource things and lose sight of what you're actually there to do in the first place. And that's definitely the model that the All Blacks run by. If you compared their, you've got one S&C, one physio and one part assistant S&C. And Gilly travels the world with his bags full of gym shoes and kit and goes gym by gym. And they don't have an HQ. Mm-hmm. They don't have a home base that Wales, for example, have a multi-million-dollar training base and a full performance team, and not to say that either one's sort of any more effective than the other, but they can be in terms of how they're cut to fit the needs.
Yeah.
So the All Blacks, I think it's the New Zealand way is to run it pretty lean, to be fair. And sometimes it's budget driven, and otherwise, because you've learnt on those shoestring budgets, you figure out what's important and you don't try and overdo it.
Yeah. It's one of the philosophies that I have when I'm, either guiding young coaches or, looking to advise on who to employ. I want to see, and these come up in this chat, is I want to see if someone who's led a program, and I also want to see someone who at one stage of their development has been a total generalist, being the go-to person for everything. Because I think if you don't have that, it's very hard to put the whole program together. It just becomes more and more and more.
Yeah, absolutely. I think having, you don't have to be an expert in every area, but to have been a generalist and across all those different areas means at least you've got an understanding of how it all fits. Yeah. And then if you're fortunate enough to use an expert in a certain space, then you know how it's going to fit into the big picture, and you can at least give that direction. That's where it becomes so key. And I found I was fortunate to work in a lower resource environment before a higher resource one, where you had to be lean and you had to be practical and you had to do a little bit of everything. So you got that understanding. If you only ever want to work in one specific space, then you might want to specialize early and you narrow your options. But if that's what spins your wheels, I know of strength coaches who don't want to deal with any of the other stuff. They just want to coach strength and someone else can take care of how that fits into the group, and in some models that fits. But essentially, if you want to lead a program and oversee all the moving parts of a program, you have to have seen them all in action and tried to do it all yourself at some point.
Learn from all those mistakes. Now, in terms of, so I said we're going to come back to your development from Tasman and moving up the ranks to Super Rugby. What have you done to deal with the travel effects, which, what are you, Christchurch to Sydney, Sydney to Joburg, Joburg, it's another 2-hour 20 flight to Cape Town.
Yep.
What have you learned and what resources do you use for that perspective?
Well, I've learned from when I first did it with New Zealand 20s for Ghana, South Africa in 2012 to when we do it now with Crusaders. I approach it a lot more simple than what I did then. Tried to find every possible way that might help in some shape or form, and you look into all the different bells and whistles and supplements, and you want to control everything, and you're still herding cats at the end of the day, and there are a bunch of 19-year-olds on a flight to a really exciting comp, so they're not exactly going to sleep when you click your fingers. So
yeah,
you have all the best place plans and invest in this perfect bag of little supplements and a little sheet that's got all the timings that you should take it to be perfect, and you get to the end of the flight and everyone's bloody pack's still full in their seat thing. So I thought we've got experienced All Blacks.
I'm not laughing at you. I've just been there. And it's, gotcha.
Yeah, Jamie Tout did a great presentation on it recently, really, where he sort of showed the same. He compared what he tried to do at one World Cup with Black Ferns compared to the next one, and how he simplified it down. And I mean, we're fortunate, so you don't see the travel as a burden because others have it worse. Every long trip that we have to make, the Highlanders have to take one more flight on the end of it to get to Dunedin from Christchurch anyway. Mm-hmm. So, and the South African teams have to tour for 4 weeks, and we only have to do two or one. So it's not that tough compared to others. And we've had in my time with Crusaders, so we've had experienced All Blacks and experienced Super Rugby players who have done it so many times before that a lot of them have got their own ways of getting through that process and getting to where they need to be. You don't need to be game ready until game day. So it's actually being not stressing out that you're not sleeping well on Monday night, because you're probably not going to be, and you don't have to be. It's just being in the right space on the right day. So, and gradually working towards that. So a lot more simple now in terms of our approach. When we go to South Africa, it's get there as soon as possible so that we've got enough days up our sleeve to have a normal training week. The priority of our training week for us is the back end of the week and the game preparation side of things. So we'll manipulate the front of the week based on travel and time zones to get the same back of the week that we'd always get. I know some South African teams base it differently. They like to get their front of the week done really well, and then if they've nailed that, they can travel late and just perform. Also, that's driven by us. We can fly back in time. We leave on Sunday, travel for over a day and land on Sunday. Whereas when you're coming home, you leave on Sunday and you're there on Tuesday. So you don't have a full week. And then when we get there, it's like in flight is still pretty simple. It's not too bad the way the flights work for us, to be fair, to sleep at the right times and try to get your watch on that time zone and try and shift to it and get the meals at the right time. But when we get there, it's like it's getting out and getting daylight at key times, getting your meal times right, being active at the right times of day, staying up until the right time in the evening to just try and get your body clock in sync, and gradually building your intensity through to the week so that Thursday, Friday, Saturday feels like anywhere else in the world.
Mm-hmm. It was interesting. So when I was doing my internship with the Sharks based in Durban, and then interacting with a lot of the New Zealanders, and so we're talking, you know, basically the turn of the century. One thing that stood out is the New Zealanders seem to enjoy traveling, like look forward to it. Hey, we're going to Africa and day trip and all that kind of stuff. Whereas the South African mindset was, we've got to go on the road for, and I think back then it might have been a little bit longer, 4 or 5 weeks. But anyway, let's call it 4 weeks. And one was going, this is different. How good is it? And others were going, this is different. I want to say others, the South Africans were going, this is different. It's not home. Yeah. It's not as good.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of other different challenges that come with it where, it's hard because we definitely don't have to spend as long away from home as the South African teams do. And that definitely does help keep your group connected. But also, you do look forward to it. You really, really look forward to it. It might be the case that you're trying to fly from a 25 degree dry Joburg winter to Christchurch and play in -3 and cold and rain. And we're like, yeah, we get back to summer for 2 weeks. And you can get the singlets out and hang around, do bombs in the pool, and the boys can go out. Then there might be just more things. You go out on safari if you haven't been there, the lion parks, and there's stuff to do, and it's just different. And also you're in that captain environment where you just get so much more connection and the little conversations that lead to performance at the weekend. And we've had a lot of players in the past that have families, and it's tough to be away from, like, it's tough at a World Cup, you're away for family for a number of months. 2 weeks you can usually get away with, and as much as they miss home, the guys with new kids are sleeping, which they don't get to do at home. And everything's sort of, you know, everything's taken care of. Like the food, you can structure more of the day, the recovery, the food, the pool's always there. So you almost run a better training and recovery week model when you're traveling, because they have to drop off kids at school and pick them up and have all the other life stuff that competes for time that you do when you're at home. So for some of them, it's a nice getaway. And for the young guys, it's really exciting. Maybe it's a mindset thing. Like we love touring. Crusaders love touring, and we vocalise that we're good at it and that we do it well. And that we enjoy it, and the language drives that.
I have a sneaky suspicion that's a big component, and that's to take nothing away from the coaching and the preparation, but I think the attitude towards it. And from my time in tennis, when we were travelling a lot, it was interesting watching the people who comparing to home and not really embracing the local, embracing the different, embracing, you know, we're in Italy, embracing the siesta, you know, stuff like that.
I think, and
it's just an interesting one. I've got no evidence, no science. It's just looking around and saying that the people who adapt the best seem to embrace it the best.
Yeah, it's probably something that it goes a little bit by the amount of resource or money that you spend or people that you put in places. We can often fall into the trap of trying to create as much perfection around a group as possible, so that all they have to do is train and play and do their job. And by doing that, we remove their ability to cope with imperfection and their ability to adapt when things don't go well. So having that, and I've definitely been in some challenges. It's been easier with Crusaders than I think 2012 with under-20s in South Africa was manageable, because we were in Cape Town. It's a rugby country. It's a rugby town. We had someone looking after us that understood rugby and the game and the clubs and players, and had looked after teams before. France the year after was sort of trying to promote the game, and you're in a soccer area of France, and our liaison wasn't a rugby person; they were more of a media person, and just trying to that was so tough. Like, I really struggled. Like, I was battling to find the right type of snacks that I wanted to, because everything was just cheese and pastry, and so it was. And there were all these little things that I had that went so easily in South Africa, because it was closer to what we were used to, and it really got to me, because you take it. At that stage of my career, you take it really personally. You're like, oh, I'm not able to do my job because I don't have what I need to do my job, so I'm doing a really bad job here, and it really gets to you. And so that was a great learning when we toured South America with Māori All Blacks, and when you're in Brazil, and the first training of the week, the bus doesn't turn up because of traffic, and you've organised a 90-minute sort of outing for the group that's supposed to be energizing, and you get stuck in traffic and it takes 5 hours and everyone's over it. And the bus drove through some power lines and took out the electricity to a little village. And you get there and the pre-match meal was actually the breakfast, and they've been swapped. And I thought, but just to expect that things might not be perfect when you're touring somewhere that's not a rugby country. Yeah. And to be able to cope with that, and for the players to know that, like, don't don't panic if baked potatoes come out instead of mashed potatoes, because mm-hmm. you're still eating a potato.
Yeah.
And even if there's no potato, there's other options. So don't get so wired into your routine that if your routine's interrupted slightly, you capitulate. And that's from a coaching side of it too. Like, it's really easy to stress over little stuff rather than the big picture. Is even if the meal came out an hour late, we were still eating 2.5 hours before kickoff. They still fueled. You're still going to play on a green rectangle with some white sticks. So it's not the end of the world. But if you try to keep perfection all the time, everything feels like the end of the world.
Yeah, no, it's interesting. Taleb's influenced my thoughts for a long time. Nassim Taleb, and just there's a lot of decisions now I realize I've made as a young coach. I was probably making my athletes more fragile. And then my attitude towards us. Simon, I've got a question from Robbie. He said, please excuse him, he had to leave. He says, thanks, Simon. Bit of a broad question. Was there any particular stage in your pathway to being at the Crusaders Super Rugby that you thought was most beneficial or important to your coaching and development? Academy, rehab, interning, what was the most important?
I think the most beneficial as a part of that pathway for me to be doing the job that I'm doing right now was working alongside our head coach, Scott Robertson, for 4 years with Canterbury and building that trust and that relationship. So that it certainly wasn't a given when he got the Crusader role that I would go in with him. It was, we built that relationship, but he was even surprised by the caliber of, you get 500 applicants and 400 of them are outstanding. Mm-hmm. So it was a pretty tough choice for him in the end. And I'm thankful that he backed me and chose to take me alongside him. But I think the way that I can do my role now, I was able to put that into place almost straight away because I didn't have to start at square one building that coaching relationship. Mm-hmm. And even outside that, having worked across different environments with different representative teams, having exposure to so many different coaches and learning how to work with different people was really beneficial. So when we came on board with the Crusaders, it was quite a staff change, and I was almost one of the only constants, which would have been in my favour in getting the role over somebody more experienced or having a different skill set or a better suited skill set. So the fit was in my favour. And all the different coaches, that they were all new to, or some of them were new to coaching in that environment, but I'd worked with them all in different environments. Mm-hmm. So I could be the connector. So I think the building that relationship and that trust and that ability to work with you, with the head coach on things, that's the most beneficial that's allowed me to do the role that I'm doing now.
Yep.
You say, and balanced with exposure to other coaches who work in completely different ways, so that you're not just one type of coach.
Yep. Now, just talking about Scott Robinson, who, you've worked with him for how many years?
This would be eight.
Hey. How have you watched him evolve over time? What do you notice that he's improving on?
We've learnt to work together over those years. Like, so you didn't see things exactly the same early on, and there's still things that we see differently, but we know how to communicate that now without getting frustrated with each other.
I
think he's always been driven to kind of learn and keep getting better. He's definitely developed in his ability to he knows who he is, he knows how he operates, he knows what he does well, but he also knows what he doesn't do well or what he's not interested in. So he knows to get people around him with those skill sets so that the group's got a little bit of everything. Mm-hmm. And he'll say that himself, like he's an ideas man. He's a great starter, but he surrounds himself with finishers.
Mm-hmm.
And I think within the environment, like Razor creates an environment where he's a bit different, and it's okay to be yourself. And so everybody's happy being the best of themselves, because you're not, even though we've got a team first mindset, that doesn't mean you have to fit the Crusader prototype. Team first is about being yourself so that what you bring to the group strengthens it in a positive way. So I think that's definitely something that's evolved over those 8 years. He's always been really tactically astute. Even as a player, he walked around with a little playbook and tried to innovate ways to kind of improve the game. So he's always sort of been a player with a coach's mind, I think. One of his real strengths is he can switch on and switch off. So we know when we're working and we know when we are relaxed. Mm-hmm. But his ability to tune into the fact that other people sometimes don't have that same ability, and he can flick between on and off like in a heartbeat, whereas others take time and they're really focused, and then you switch off for a bit and they get taken off track and it takes them a while to get back on board. Or others who, right, we relax now, and then you struggle to get your focus back. And there's so many different individual dynamics in a group that he's probably got a better feel for the room now than early on. I'd say is what one thing he'd say around when to bring switch on, switch off, and bring the group with him. Mm-hmm. His feel for the room and his empathy for the room is stronger than what he's potentially just feeling himself. So that's definitely been a growth. And I think one of the real key things, he trusts all of us just to nail our jobs. Yep. He doesn't micromanage, and he doesn't, if you need support or if a decision needs to be made, he knows that's his role. But he doesn't try to do your job for you. He trusts you to tell him what you need.
Yep, that's awesome. All right. Well, guys, I'm going to feel free again, flick through some questions. I've got a couple more for Simon, and then we're going to take the mics off mute. So be prepared for that. Simon, books. Do you have any recommendations that you think that have influenced your either coaching or S&C or just life?
Yeah, I'm probably a bit millennial. Like I've got a massive pile of books in the office that I haven't touched for a long time. But in terms of different podcasts and things that are online and ways to quickly absorb information and things like this have been really important and really good for me recently. To the point, yeah, you can sign into too many and get a bit zoomed out or podcasted out if you roll through 20 of them back to back. But books, I've come back to just books, I think. I haven't even finished it yet because I get that distracted by ideas and try and figure out how I'll put them into place. Conscious coaching with Brett Bartholomew has got some awesome concepts in it that's the bit that engages me, is that interpersonal side and the dynamics over the mechanics. There's so many great textbooks around the mechanics and the nuts and bolts side of things, but you learn pretty quickly when you come straight out of study and try and put it into practice in the real world, what works out of the textbook and what doesn't, and how to pick and choose and make things fit. So that as a coaching and a holistic perspective, I've found really valuable. Other ones from the coaching side that aren't necessarily S&C focused, like we always have a campaign theme for Canterbury or Crusaders, a story that drives our culture and we tie our journey to for that year. So you've always got a book to read or something to read that relates to that. And so we've had some really good ones in previous years that have had some great books by coaches. So both of Phil Jackson's books, where he's either talking about his time at the Bulls or Sacred Hoops or mm-hmm. Or his time at the Lakers, Score Takes Care of Itself, Bill Walsh from the 49ers and their days of dominating their era. They've got some incredible interpersonal coaching aspects to them. And one at the moment that I'm probably going to reread is Ben Ryan's book around and his experiences of going from England sevens to Fiji sevens and the million-dollar budgets to just him and a whistle and the sand dunes and Singatoka and all of the stories. I like those books where you can you get context and it's someone talking about their experience and what they learned and the mistakes that they made and how they grew, and because I can see the picture in my mind. Mm-hmm. But there are probably some key ones sort of recently that I've sort of taken quite a lot out of for different reasons.
Okay, awesome. That gives us some reading material. All right, who's up for a question? John, I didn't ask your question, but if you want to ask it now.
That's all right. My question, Simon, is actually about the the culture within the All Blacks. You hear a lot coming out from the media about the no dickheads policy and how that, because I've read that book, Legacy, about the mental skills coach that was embedded with the All Blacks and how it filters down into the provinces. I was wondering if you could expand on that a little bit, how it's implemented, how it's enforced, and any dealings you might have had with it.
Yeah, it's a good question, John. I think like I've had snapshots of the All Black environment sort of in and out, but I've probably had daily interactions with players who are in the All Blacks for a number of years. So you just get to see those things in action. And as I said before, it's a culture is it's the series of ongoing relationships within a group and how those relationships function. And it's about the standards that are acceptable and the standards that aren't, and the having the ability or the safety within a group to hold yourself and each other accountable to those standards without it being personal, because it's about this big picture that you're trying to achieve in terms of an environment and a culture and just a way of living and a way of operating that's more about growth and getting better every day and helping other people be successful, not just helping yourself be successful. So that's certainly it goes across, and it looks in different shapes and forms in different environments. They say, and Highlanders will talk about being a Highlander man, and the Crusaders will talk about being a Crusader man. And there's there's Chief Mana, and there's a lot of different ways of putting these things together. It's just about having, if everybody's really clear and everybody actually takes ownership, and people are trying to invest in something and grow it, then they'll own it. And people are, so if you own a house, you're more likely to do things to either keep or grow its value. Then if you're renting a house, there's plenty of students out there that rent in a house and bash it up in the last party and don't worry about getting their bond back at the end of it and move on and let the owner take care of fixing it up. So I'd say the real underpinning part that goes through all those different environments from the All Blacks down is that having really good leaders and an approach where your leadership group really display those on a daily basis, and even your younger players lead in different ways. They lead with energy and the old guys lead with experience. But it's all held to a really clear sort of, to go to Bill Walsh from the book, your standard of performance, and to read Score Takes Care of Itself by him, he goes into so much detail around the standard of performance that he put into place at the 49ers, from the players to the person who answers the phone at the front desk. And what that looks like. And Ash talked about it on a previous chat with you, which is one of Brent Frew's pieces of gold about the three different types of people with the rubbish on the floor. Mm-hmm. And the top that you either, you don't see it, walk past it, or you see it and walk past it, or you see it and pick it up and put it in the bin. So it's knowing what those things look like on a daily basis and actually creating that picture. Otherwise, it's just words on a page or words on a wall. And I guess the way that we've framed it recently is it sort of another quote from, I don't know where, but the standard that you're willing to walk past is a standard that you'll accept. So if you're going to turn a blind eye to something, then you're condoning a standard that's below the line and below where it needs to be. So it's about creating a really clear picture, what it looks like on a daily basis, whether it's sweeping the shed, shaking someone's hand when they come in, giving eye contact when you connect and fist bump your mate in the morning, those little things, the little daily things that all add up.
Oh, awesome. Thank you so much.
Guys, any other questions for Simon? There we go. Justin. Justin and then Soph. Justin just beat you there and then we'll
All good.
I was going to say, if she has one question, I got two questions. So maybe Soph can go first.
No, do your first one, then we'll go Justin, Soph, Justin.
All right. Thanks for your time, Simon. You talked about how your coach tended to work well with switching on and switching off and, in a sense, decompartmentalising. I suppose, I'm guessing you would have talked to him about it. What kind of methods do you use to try and decompartmentalise, especially obviously when you're leaving work and going home? And I suppose, what have you learned from him in that sense?
Yeah, that's a good question, because they're two really good concepts. I think what I've learnt from Razor is probably, I think early on in my career, like with the textbook focus and kind of knowing what performance should look like, it's really easy to look at everything too seriously and forget that a lot of people have a lot of different why in driving them for being there. And some people are there to connect with others, and some are really highly professional because they're internally driven to be that way. And others like the social aspect of things a whole lot more and have a different driver. So I've probably learnt from Razor to better understand that every individual has a slightly different driver and a slightly different way of going about things, and to get real engagement and commitment rather than compliance, it's finding out what that why is and engaging with that and not getting frustrated if somebody else's why or their approach is different to yours. And for myself, I've probably, well, one of the things I do when we're away on tour, you always get a day off. Like I enjoy working with people. That's what I love doing every day. But for me, naturally, I'm probably more introverted than extroverted, and being around people and noise all the time wears me out. So when it comes to day off, rather than going out and trying to find one of the groups to join on safari or down at the mall, or like that's my day to myself to kind of recharge my batteries. And I just know that I need time away from people and noise to recharge. Whereas Razor's the opposite. If he was alone, like he'd be battling at the moment because he just by himself and family, and other people need to draw energy from others, and that's how they recharge their batteries. So that's probably what I've found for myself is, as much as I enjoy what I do, one of the real key parts of it is, it might be just the amount that you put into it, but it does drain your battery. And the best way for me to recharge is a bit of quiet time by myself, just to switch off before I get out in front of the group or around the group again.
Soph, you want to ask your question?
Yes. So my question, not at all philosophical like everyone else's are. Can you just run us through like what a typical, let's say, mid pre-season day at the Crusaders might be, and also what you ask of your players the day after a game?
Yep, no problem. Pre-season for us is a bit different to what it was in the past. So I'm fortunate that we put the challenge on our players to turn up fit, so that we don't have to spend pre-season time on fitness. We spend it on rugby. So a normal pre-season day now is a lot more rugby focused than physical focus, and it's more around the match readiness and match fitness type stuff than general fitness. If we had a longer period, I'd probably go back to doing a bit more variation and a bit more cross training. This year was we didn't have long, so the longer we took to get to rugby, the worse we were going to perform in round one. So turn up fit so we can practice rugby, and they became really similar to our in-season days, but there's individuals that need a little bit more of certain things, whether it's a boxing session on the back end or something, or a bit more wrestling and instead of gym lifting, because they need that type of strength more. But we've shortened our days in the pre-season. We've found we've got more out of less in the last couple of years. So I changed it this year.
Is that because you've got a more mature squad or what?
Yeah, it is. In a way, it is. And also, I think you're successful at the start of Super Rugby if you understand your game and execute it well, because everybody's fit. Whereas at the back end of the season, everybody's been reviewing and previewing all year. So that's when your physical status probably takes more hold of your performance. To have a healthy team and a fit team and a robust team and a team that can play at a high level consistently. So we probably build the physical model through the in-season now, and we build the rugby model through the pre-season. Having said that, if everyone turned up unfit, we couldn't do that. So... But this year I separated out and we went rugby day, strength day, rugby day, strength day, because I just wanted them to focus on one thing at a time and do it really, really well. Whereas in the past, I've probably gone rugby in the morning, lunch, break, sleep if you need to, lift in the afternoon. But we had a bit more of a focus on absorption of information and recovery through the afternoons, and really heavily loaded the mornings with one thing or the other. And that was basically just because that's what I felt this group needed, was to not try and do two different things in one day to get our rugby where it needed to be. A younger group, I'd probably do it the other way, and I'd stack the days because they need to learn that you train and lift in the same day. And that's just the reality of professional footy in season. So it changes every year a little bit based on the group. But it was probably one of the differences this year, was it was a lot more rugby focused, and we didn't try to do two different things on one day, which we probably normally would.
Do you think you'll stick with that approach going forward? Did it work better, do you think?
I think it was really effective, because we got the players just turn up and lift really well, because they know they just got to get a really good lift in, and then the rest of the day's off. And so they're not turning up fatigued from the morning. And as we get closer to the season, we start to build that, well, I need to lift under fatigue, because what you can do under fatigue's more important now. But it was good. It was really effective, because we didn't have to compromise things as much. We just focused a bit more intently. I'd do it again if I had enough time. I think whatever the length of the next preseason looks like will determine what we do with it. And the priority of physical over rugby and the balance. What was the other question? Sorry.
Just what you expect what you want your players to do the day after a game.
Correct. So we at home it's quite different. We're pretty self driven in terms of recovery. We put a bit of time into, as I said before, what fills individuals' batteries the most, and for some people, like different things work better. If we sort of force them to do things that they're not really that into, it's not really recovery, it's just more stress. so we have a really good a process in the past. We've sat down with each individual and been able to bring out of them, well, what do you feel works best for you at these key times? And then they can essentially commit to those two things because they've said it works for them. So they've chosen it, so they'll nail that. And then here's some other parts that we want to do. So it's based on match minutes and match exposure, and whether you played or whether you didn't, and how many minutes. Some of our young players like to come in on a Sunday and get their Monday lift and any top-up running done to declutter their Monday so they can focus on rugby learning. Other older players are different. Sunday's the only family day they get, so they just accept a really stacked Monday. So we create that flexibility of the day after a game, that balance between recovery and physical topping up or uploading, and give them the option to complete some of their Monday work on a Sunday if it's what suits their week better. But recovery-wise, the ideal scenario, they'd all get in water of some fashion, whether at the pool or the beach, or they might do some hot colds and a spin and a flush at rugby park, at HQ, or whatever that might look like. But it's nailing nutrition and figure out if you had a high match load, focus on the physical recovery elements. If you sat on the bench for 79 minutes and got on for the last 30 seconds and you're pissed off at the coaches, you don't need to recover physically. You need to kind of work that stuff out and just go and do something you enjoy, and don't turn up still pissed off on Monday. Vague answer to it.
No, that was great. Thank you.
Dust, do you want to ask your second question? And then Ash has got a question.
Second time around. More so academy structures. So you said you've kind of worked up through the academies and you have a really good perspective because you've kind of gone from that different part of the garden to, in a sense, top of the tree. I suppose, how do you guys do it, and how would you recommend people do it in terms of the processes to try and understand where players need to be at different stages? So I suppose the expectations when a player is in their under 19, I suppose, what do you guys set where it's like, okay, you guys need to learn how to squat, or you need to learn how to do your recovery strategies better and things like that, if that makes sense.
Yeah. I think one of the things I've found is as a real strength of the, it was Canterbury Academy, now it's the Christchurch base of Crusader Academy, is there's such a good investment in those players. The S&C side of things has done well, but that's done well everywhere because that's sort of the easy part. But the mentoring of the technical and tactical and game understanding side, because your ability to play the game is the most critical thing by far. So having those elements of the skill sessions, the mentoring, the game understanding at that academy level, like we found that bringing academy players in to train with us, like their skills and their strength and conditioning work's done really well, and it's a real focus at that level. And the gap that we've found when they come to Super Rugby is the amount of clips to watch and homework to do, and you've got to actually get up and speak to the team about the defensive strategy. And so we've gone more down the road of inviting academy players into our meetings so that they can see the mental load of professional footy and what that takes. And you say, like, at the moment, the players are fresh as anything because all they have to do is train, and they don't have to sit at meetings and look at lineouts and talk to coaches and go through all the analysis and review and preview, which is critical, but it's also, it's pretty draining too. So a real balance of those two elements is really key. I think Ash said it as well around, you know, there's a lot of strength and conditioning academies, but this is a rugby academy, and that's its real core purpose and core focus. And that's our core role, is to support the rugby program and the rugby coaches, not the other way around. So, but having a structure and a process is really important, and they are focused more on development than performance for that. For us, it's a 3-year process if they get through the full 3 years and don't get snapped up with a contract early. But there's little elements along the way where there's an under-19s tournament or they go away to play for New Zealand 20s where actually performance is important, because that's where they can put themselves on the radar to go further. So sort of you do have to strike that balance and not come from the academy perspective and say, well, we're developing physically, so I don't care, under-19 coaches, whether you win or not, because we're a development program. For those couple of weeks, actually, let's just focus on performance, because it's a very small window, and then you go back to that long-term development model again. So it's probably it's flicking between the balance of development and performance. It's mostly development, but with little windows of performance, whereas the more you can invest in that, then the more when they come to Super Rugby, it's a performance window, you know, with pieces of development. So they're probably the real key balances, I'd say, to have is the S&C to the rugby side is really important, and the development and performance side.
Do you divide that up in a sense? So, like, and you spoke about how now with your Crusaders, you split it up into days where it's rugby or it's physical days. Do you,
yep,
within that, I suppose, academy system, do you split up the, I suppose, even months and say, okay, this next few months we're going to really want to work on rugby specifically?
Yeah, it is in a way, because we don't have an academy team, it's an academy process. So the academy don't play as a team, they play for their clubs. So you're not in a season cycle, so you can actually have more of a kind of a linear or a block periodization type model in place for that long-term development. Whereas it's a lot more of a melting pot when they're at that performance level, when you're trying to do everything at once and focus on one thing at different times. So there is, I think, the way that Stefan and Webby do it now, that it's definitely a step progression across the 3 years, from coming in and learning the basics to being able to leave after 3 years with a good understanding, self-reliant, and professional, and knowing what the expectations are, whether you're a Crusader or a Highlander or you go and play for Exeter or whatever it may be, that they grow through the process and gradually take more ownership. And we really benefit from that with the players that come from the academy into our team, because they get it. And they say they're physically well prepared, they're skillful, but they understand the mental side. So you work across the different pillars that are there around that, your physical, your nutritional, your holistic, and your outside career balance and life balance side of things, your technical, your tactical, and your mental skills. So the structure is within those pillars, and then you say you work your way through an educational process of how you prioritise those at different times, going from being a bit more prescriptive in year one to really giving a lot more ownership by the time they're at year three. And the year three academy players play a massive part of leading the academy program.
Okay. Awesome. Justin, we've got one question from Ash. She's going to, actually, I can turn her mic off mute for her. Ash, your question.
I've been stitched up by Grant, but that's okay.
She was a former intern, and I've challenged her to ask a question. And that's the context.
And I'm just asking one of Grant's questions, because if you could go back in time, what's one thing you'd like to tell your younger self?
I'd say follow your instinct, because I probably this is where I would have liked to have been, but didn't necessarily believe that I'd be able to get there. So actually, really, if you're passionate about something, like, chase it and chase it hard, but be open to the fact that your views on it might change and you might need to divert a little bit. So I guess what I mean by that was, when I was working away at Tasman and I wanted to work for the Crusaders, then I got to a point where actually, the Crusaders isn't going to be the be-all and end-all. I'm open to any Super Rugby environment now, because I'm not sure if I'm going to get a crack there. And so being able to actually be comfortable with that, like, don't be worried about the fact that I haven't progressed, because sometimes that's opportunity, sometimes it's fit. But if you love doing what you're doing, just keep doing it, and things will evolve from there. And actually, I think it would be to believe in myself a bit more that I'm actually going to get there, because you start doubting yourself at some point, and you start thinking, where am I going to end up? What am I going to end up doing? And is it all going to pan out? So, be really open to diverting, but, you know, don't give up on what you're chasing if you're really, really passionate about it.
Yeah, definitely.
Great question, Ash.
Thanks, G.
Well asked.
All right, Simon, I just want to thank you for your time. I see there's no more questions coming through, so thank you for your insights. Thank you for sharing your experience. Guys, if I can just say, if you haven't made a donation, there's no pressure. Simon hasn't asked, and I definitely won't force any receipts for the donation, but there is the White Cloud Foundation. You can click on donate, or you can do it of a charity of your choice. Coming up next, we've got some great chats. Sophia Nymphius from ECU. We've got Jeremy Hickmans coming up. Obviously, one of my mentors, Stefan Widmar, who was 5-time Australian Swim Coach of the Year and helped me tremendously when I started working with female athletes. But he's just a magnificent coach. Guys, thank you. And thanks for all the people who are messaging. Si, you're getting a lot of messages coming through privately. So thank you for your time.
All good.
And guys, tomorrow we've got an AMA, Ask Me Anything. We haven't announced it yet, but if you are interested in being in it, we're going to keep it very, very small. So please DM me or email me to get on the list, and we can have a chat there and move on from there. Simon Thomas, thank you very much for your time. Much appreciated.
Good
luck for whatever is salvaged for the rest of the year.
Yeah, no problem. I thank you. Thanks for because it's a privilege to be involved in some of the mentors and the names that I've listened to prior and scrolled through the list. And then thanks for your work that you do to bring us all together, and then everybody else on the call. Look, these things don't happen unless people engage. So anybody could be talking, but we'd be talking to ourselves if you weren't here. So thank you for your time.
Simon, absolute pleasure. See you guys. Catch you later.